purpose of this weapon makes its very existence and the knowledge of its construction a danger to humanity as a whole. It is necessarily an evil thing considered in any light. For these reasons, we believe it important for the President of the United States to tell the American public and the world, we think it is wrong on fundamental ethical principles to initiate a program of development of such a weapon. Secretary of State Dean Acheson and AEC Commissioner Louis Strauss did not agree, nor did the Democratic Majority Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Joint Congressional Atomic Energy Committee. On January 31st, President Harry Truman announced publicly that he had directed the AEC to continue with its work on all forms of atomic energy weapons, including the so-called hydrogen or superbomb. The GAC had also recommended that enough be declassified about the superbomb so that a public statement of policy can be made at this time. But that recommendation went the way of a pledge not to initiate the development. Oppenheimer and Conant, having been overruled on this vital issue, thought of resigning from the GAC. But Acheson, precisely because he didn't want the public to be aware of any opposition to the program, or to inquire about the reasons for it, urged them not to. So they didn't, nor did Fermi or Hans Bethe, who also strongly opposed the development prior to Truman's decision, cease to be active consultants on it. Nor did anyone else, to my knowledge, leave the program, with one exception I learned of many years later. Surprisingly enough, that was my father. As I have previously related, my father had spent the war designing factories to build bombing planes and engines for them. When the war ended, he accepted an offer to oversee the buildup of the plutonium production facilities at Hanford, Washington. That project was being run first by DuPont, then by General Electric under contract with the Atomic Energy Commission. To take the job of chief structural engineer on the project, Dad moved from the engineering firm of Albert Kahn, where he had worked for years, to what became Giffels and Rossetti. As he later told me, that engineering firm had the largest volume of construction contracts in the world at that time, and his project was the world's largest. I grew up hearing these superlatives. The Hanford project gave my father his first really good pay. But while I was away as a sophomore at Harvard, Dad left his job with Giffels and Rossetti, for reasons I never learned at the time. He was out of work for almost a year. Then he went back as chief structural engineer for the whole firm. Almost 30 years later, when my father was 89, I happened to ask him why he had left Giffels and Rossetti. His answer startled me. He said, "Because they wanted me to help build the H-bomb." This was a breathtaking statement for me to hear in 1978. That year I was in full-time active opposition to the deployment of the neutron bomb, a small H-bomb, that President Jimmy Carter was proposing to send to Europe. The N-bomb had a killing radius from its output of neutrons that was much wider than its radius of destruction by blast. Optimally, an airburst N-bomb would produce little fallout. Its neutrons would kill humans either outside or within buildings or tanks, while sparing structures, equipment, or vehicles. The Soviets mocked it as a capitalist weapon that destroyed people but not property. But they tested such a weapon too, as did other countries. I had opposed developing or testing that concept for almost 20 years, since it was first described to me by my friend and colleague at RAND, Sam Cohen, who liked to be known as the father of the neutron bomb. He wanted me to evaluate the strategic implications of such a weapon, hoping I would support his campaign for deploying it. To his great disappointment, after studying his earnest descriptions of its properties, I told him I thought it would be too dangerous to develop or possess. I feared that, as a low-yield tactical battlefield weapon with limited and seemingly controllable lethal effects, it would be seen, delusionally, as usable in warfare, making U.S. first use in pursuit of limited nuclear war more likely. It would be the match that would set off an exchange of the much larger dirty weapons with widespread fallout, which made up the bulk of our own arsenal, and were all that the Soviets then had. In the year of this 1978 conversation with Dad, I was arrested 4 times in Colorado, while blocking the railroad tracks at the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Production Facility, which produced all the plutonium triggers for H-bombs and was going to produce the plutonium cores for neutron bombs. One of these arrests was on Nagasaki Day, August 9, 1978. The triggers produced at Rocky Flats were, in effect, the nuclear components of A-bombs, plutonium fission bombs of the type that had destroyed Nagasaki on that date in 1945. Every one of our many thousands of H-bombs, the thermonuclear fusion bombs that arm our strategic forces, requires a Nagasaki-type A-bomb as its detonator. I doubt that one American in 100 knows that simple fact, and thus has a clear understanding of the difference between A and H-bombs, or of the reality of the thermonuclear arsenals of the last 50 years. Our popular image of nuclear war, from the familiar pictures of the devastation of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, is grotesquely misleading. Those pictures show us only what happens to humans and buildings when they are hit by what is now just the detonating cap for a modern nuclear weapon. The plutonium for these weapons came from Hanford and from the Savannah River site in Georgia and was machined into weapons components at Rocky Flats in Colorado. The poet Allen Ginsberg and I, with many others, blockaded the entrances to the plant on August 9th to interfere with business as usual at the bomb factory on the anniversary of the day a plutonium bomb had killed 58,000 humans. About 100,000 had died by the end of 1945. I had never before heard of any connection between my father and the H-bomb. He wasn't particularly wired into my anti-nuclear work, or to any of my activism since the Vietnam War had ended. I asked him what he meant by his comment about why he had left Giffels and Rossetti. "They wanted me to be in charge of designing a big plant that would be producing material for an H-bomb." He said that DuPont, which had built the Hanford site, was to have the contract from the Atomic Energy Commission. That would have been for the Savannah River site. I asked him when this was. "Late 49. I told him, "You must have the date wrong. You couldn't have heard about the hydrogen bomb then. It's too early." I'd just been reading about the whole H-bomb controversy and the GAC report in Herb York's recent book, The Advisors, New York, 1976. The GAC meeting on the issue of a crash program had been in October 1949. I said to Dad, "Truman didn't make the decision to go ahead till January 1950. Meanwhile, the whole thing was super secret. You couldn't have heard about it in 49. My father said, "Well, somebody had to design the plant if they were going to go ahead. I was the logical person. I was in charge of the structural engineering of the whole project at Hanford after the war. I had a Q clearance." That was the first I'd ever heard that he'd had a Q clearance, an AEC clearance, higher than top secret, for nuclear weapons design and stockpile data. I'd had that clearance myself in the Pentagon, along with close to a dozen other special clearances above top secret, after I left the RAND Corporation for the Defense Department in 1964. It was news to me that my father had ever had any security clearance, but it made sense that he would have needed it for Hanford. I said, "So you're telling me that you would have been one of the only people in the country, outside Los Alamos and the GAC, who knew we were considering building the H-bomb in 1949? He said, "I suppose so. Anyway, I know it was late 49 because that's when I quit." "Why did you quit?" "I didn't want to make an H-bomb. Why, that thing was going to be 1,000 times more powerful than the A-bomb." I thought, score one for his memory at 89. He remembered the proportion correctly. That was the same factor Oppenheimer and the others predicted in their report in 1949. They were right. The first explosion of a droppable H-bomb almost 5 years later had 1,000 times the explosive power of the Hiroshima blast. My father went on, "I hadn't wanted to work on the A-bomb either, but then Einstein seemed to think that we needed it, and it made sense to me that we had to have it against the Russians. So I took the job, but I never felt good about it. Then when they told me they were going to build a bomb 1,000 times bigger, that was it for me. I went back to my office and I said to my deputy, 'These guys are crazy. They have an A-bomb. Now they want an H-bomb. They're going to go right through the alphabet till they have a Z-bomb. I said, well, so far they've only gotten to N. He said, there was another thing about it that I couldn't stand. Building these things generated a lot of radioactive waste. I wasn't responsible for designing the containers for the waste, but I knew they were bound to leak eventually. That stuff was deadly forever. It was radioactive for 24,000 years. Again, he had turned up a good figure. I said, your memory is working pretty well. It would be deadly a lot longer than that, but that's about the half-life of plutonium. There were tears in his eyes. He said huskily, I couldn't stand the thought that I was working on a project that was poisoning parts of my own country forever, that might make parts of it uninhabitable for thousands of years. I thought over what he'd said. Then I asked him if anyone else working with him had had misgivings. He didn't know.
Were you the only one who quit?
He said yes. He was leaving the best job he'd ever had, and he didn't have any other to turn to. He lived on savings for a while and did some consulting. I thought about Oppenheimer and Conant, both of whom had recommended dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, but who, that same month Dad was resigning, along with Fermi and Robbie, had expressed internally their opposition to the development of the superbomb, in the most extreme terms possible. It was, they had said, potentially a weapon of genocide, which carried, much further than the atomic bomb itself, the policy of exterminating civilian populations, whose power of destruction is essentially unlimited, a threat to the future of the human race which is intolerable, a danger to humanity as a whole, necessarily an evil thing considered in any light. Not one of these men had risked their status in the nuclear establishment by sharing with the American public at the time their expert judgment that the president's course fatally endangered humanity, nor had they refrained from supporting it once Edward Teller and Stan Ulam had come up with a design that would work early in 1951. I asked my father what made him feel so strongly to act in a way that nobody else had done. He said, you did. That didn't make any sense. I said, what do you mean? We didn't discuss this at all. I didn't know anything about it. Dad said, it was earlier. I remember you came home with a book one day, and you were crying. It was about Hiroshima. You said, Dad, you've got to read this. It's the worst thing I've ever read. I said that must have been John Hersey's book, Hiroshima, in 1946. I didn't remember giving it to him. Yes, well, I read it, and you were right. That's when I started to feel bad about working on an atomic bomb project. And then when they said they wanted me to work on a hydrogen bomb, it was too much for me. I thought it was time for me to get out. I asked if he had told his bosses why he was quitting. He said he told some people, not others. The ones he told seemed to understand his feelings. In fact, in less than a year, the head of the firm called to say that they wanted him to come back as chief structural engineer for the whole firm. They were dropping the General Electric contract. They didn't say why, so he wouldn't have to have anything to do with the AEC or bomb making. He stayed with them till he retired. I said finally, Dad, how could I not have ever heard any of this before? How come you never said anything about it? My father said, oh, I couldn't tell any of this to my family. You weren't cleared. Well, I finally started getting my clearances in 1958, 10 years after my father gave his up. They turned out to be useful in the end. In 1969, they allowed me to read the top-secret Pentagon papers and to keep them in my safe at the Rand Corporation, from which I delivered copies of them that year to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and later to 19 newspapers. But in an important sense, for a decade before that, my clearances had been my undoing, and not only mine, precisely because we were exposed to secret intelligence estimates, in particular from the Air Force. I and my colleagues at the Rand Corporation were preoccupied in the late 50s with the urgency of averting nuclear war by deterring a Soviet surprise attack that would exploit an alleged missile gap. That supposed dangerous U.S. inferiority was exactly as unfounded in reality as the earlier Manhattan Project fear of a Nazi crash bomb program had been. Or to pick a more recent example, as concern over Saddam Hussein's supposed possession of weapons of mass destruction in 2003. Working conscientiously, obsessively, on a wrong problem, countering an illusory threat, I and my colleagues at RAND had distracted ourselves and helped distract others from dealing with real dangers posed by the mutual superpower pursuit of nuclear weapons, dangers which we were helping make worse, and from real opportunities to make the world more secure. Unintentionally, yet inexcusably, we made our country and the world less safe. I have known for a long time that official secrecy and deceptions about our nuclear weapons posture and policies and their possible consequences threaten the survival of the human species. To understand the urgency of radical changes in our nuclear policies that may truly move the world toward the elimination of doomsday machines and ultimately to abolition of nuclear weapons, we need a new understanding of the real history of the nuclear age. I turn now to one more chapter in that hidden history. Chapter 19. The Strangelove Paradox. Yes, but the whole point of the doomsday machine is lost if you keep it a secret. Why didn't you tell the world, eh? Dr. Strangelove. When Daniel Ford, the former executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists, published his well-researched book, The Button, in 1985, he could get no official comments on the question implied by his title, How many fingers are on the nuclear button? Did official predelegation exist, as logic suggested and various people had hinted or speculated, or did it not? From Donald Latham, Assistant Secretary of Defense under Reagan for Command and Control Systems, he received this answer. Well, there are contingency plans. I just really can't discuss them. That, he noted, was about all the Pentagon would say about the subject. Ford then quotes Desmond Ball, the extraordinarily well-informed Australian defense analyst, as commenting to him, This is probably one of the most closely kept secrets. Indeed. Going back to 1960, a quarter century before Ford's investigation, the answer to his query was given to me as a highly sensitive secret, perhaps the most highly guarded secret in the American military system, in confidence that I would not reveal it to the U.S. public or the world, thereby contradicting a decade of explicit denials by the highest American authorities that any such predelegation existed. That confidence in my discretion was justified at the time. But there was, and still is, a stunning paradox here. Why has it been kept secret at all? Especially from our adversaries. After all, the most compelling and legitimate purpose of delegation by the President has always been to assure that the Soviets, or now Russians, could not paralyze our retaliatory forces by a decapitating attack on Washington, D.C., or by attacking the President wherever he might be. But even more important than establishing that reality is to make sure that the adversary also understands, recognizes, and believes that reality beyond any doubt. Otherwise, in a crisis or faced with a possibly false warning of a U.S. attack, any enemy uncertainty about presidential delegation could nourish hope that its best chance, perhaps its only chance, of survival, was precisely to launch a decapitating attack against the U.S. Capitol and our major known command posts. To deter such a reckless action, surely nothing could be more important than convincing our adversary that such hopes were futile, that destroying our leadership would not prevent or even reduce the devastation they should expect. Secrecy about this, denial of it, refusal to confirm rumors about it, could only have the opposite effect. Of course, there was no way that the Soviets would have been certain that such delegation existed. Even presidential statements that it did exist could be disbelieved. But a declaratory policy that it did not exist, as the American public was repeatedly told, and that only the president himself, or a successor brought into possession of his football, could launch nuclear strikes, would only strengthen the hopes of Soviet planners that there was, after all, a form of preemptive attack that could allow them to survive and even prevail. A decapitating attack, in the absence of any U.S. delegation, might actually paralyze U.S. retaliation, or at least cause a significant delay. After all, that was the logic of our own secret military planning, with its emphasis on Moscow as the highest priority target. Such Soviet planning was not just conjectural. As Ford put it, Soviet strategists have written extensively about the need to bring the disorganization of the enemy's state and military command control, particularly for strategic weapons. He quotes a Soviet article describing this objective in detail in 1966, a time when the Soviets still had too few missiles to target all our Minuteman missiles, and yet were deploying SS-9 missiles with 20-megaton warheads, clearly intended for the 100 highly hardened Minuteman control centers. With such an approach, it was certain that they would also target the high civil military command in the Pentagon and D.C. area. Secrecy about any U.S. delegation not only encouraged such planning, but also could stimulate desperate hopes in the midst of a crisis, that it was actually better to execute these plans than to await a possible U.S. attack on their own command system. In other words, such secrecy lowered deterrence of a Soviet decapitating strike in a crisis. But the situation became much worse than that under Carter and Reagan. The long-standing JCS and SAC desire to attack Moscow and the whole Soviet command and control system had remained a tightly guarded secret from the era of Eisenhower through Ford. But as early as 1977, and especially in 1978 through 1980, there were frequent leaks and official statements that the special focus of strategic nuclear planning under President Carter, pressed by his national security assistant, Zbigniew Brzezinski, was decapitation of the Soviet command system. The Reagan administration continued both the emphasis and the openness about it. In other words, secrecy about our plans to nullify Soviet decapitating attacks by delegation, which have persisted up to the present, was now joined by publicity about our intentions to decapitate the Soviets. In fact, it was in the late Carter years that the term decapitation first acquired public currency as an official objective. Leon Sloss, a Pentagon official, was given the task at the beginning of the Carter administration in 1977 of updating the guidance on nuclear operations. He told me years later that the first thing I did was to pull out of a top-secret file safe in the Pentagon my old 1961 draft guidance for planning for general nuclear war, finished on my 30th birthday. He had remembered it. He said it was the starting point for his own work. If so, he soon departed from it radically. According to that earlier guidance, an essential part of a coercive strategy aimed at ending the war short of total annihilation on both sides was to withhold attacks on the opponent's command structure. But as a consequence of this review, as Sloss wrote later, increased emphasis in U.S. nuclear weapons employment policy was given to the targeting of enemy military forces and political military leadership, the Soviet command structure. Ford quotes General Bruce K. Holloway, the former commander-in-chief of SAC, as writing in 1980 that U.S. war aims included prevention of the loss of our way of life, damage limitation, and the degradation of the Soviet state and its control apparatus to such an extent as to make successful negotiation possible. In achieving these objectives, the importance of crippling the Soviet command and control system assumes extraordinary proportions. Nothing could so decisively preclude successful negotiations than to destroy at the outset the opposing command authorities. With whom would these negotiations be carried out? What ability would we have left them to control their operations, implement any deal, or terminate their own attacks? Those were questions I had raised in 1961. Their logic was probably never accepted by SAC for a moment, certainly not by General Holloway, whose memo in 1980 Ford quotes further. Degradation of the overall political and military control apparatus must be the primary targeting objective. Irrespective of whether we strike first or respond to a Soviet strike, presumably counterforce, it assumes the importance of absolute priority planning. Striking first would offer a tremendous advantage, and would emphasize degrading the highest political and military control to the greatest possible degree. Obviously, the success of this would depend on the Soviets eschewing any delegation, unlike ourselves, that would assure a devastating response to a U.S. attack on their high command. Holloway indicated explicitly his confidence that the Soviets would be more conservative in this sense than the U.S. I am convinced that in the Soviet system there is such centralized control that it would be possible to degrade very seriously their military effectiveness for nuclear or any other kind of war if the command-control system were severely disrupted. Major damage would be difficult to achieve and would require better intelligence than now possible, better reconnaissance and better clandestine inputs. But it can be done. Moreover, it must be done, because there is no other targeting strategy that can achieve the war aims that underwrite survival. In other words, the compelling incentive in the eyes of the former Sinksack, and certainly not only for him, to decapitate the Soviet system at the outset of hostilities, reflects the hope that it might paralyze Soviet forces to the extent that the U.S. could survive a nuclear war, and the belief that no other approach could do this. Every other strategy is seen, realistically, as a no-win option, or more seriously, a no-survival approach. Nevertheless, in planning to deal with a desperate situation, and in supporting Air Force and Navy budgeting for lots of accurate missiles for an illusory goal of winning or surviving a thermonuclear war, the supposed possibility of averting otherwise certain annihilation, no matter how slim that chance, has an attraction that tends to be irresistible. This would not have been a big surprise to the Soviets. They undoubtedly took it for granted in our planning. McNamara had announced publicly the possibility of withholding an attack on Moscow in his Ann Arbor commencement speech of 1962, but that was, after all, only an option. Soviet military planners probably regarded it with a good deal of incredulity. Thus, at the same time in the late 60s, as they were preparing for SS-9 attacks on Minuteman control centers, they were building 2,000 underground bunkers for Soviet military officials and Communist Party leaders. More than 100,000 of them, with 75 relocation centers in Moscow, some of them several hundred feet deep. Since we had not been as thorough in multiplying underground centers, there was indeed what General Buck Turgidson had feared in Dr. Strangelove, a mineshaft gap. But the new publicity a decade later, about a renewed U.S. preoccupation with destroying these very shelters, had to undermine whatever confidence Soviet leaders had in their own survival, even for long enough to order retaliation. Indeed, that was proclaimed as the very purpose of our plans and emerging military capabilities. Large numbers of ICBMs, each with multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, MIRVs, allowing for a number of warheads with separate targets on each missile, with larger yield and greatly increased accuracy for our Minuteman and sub-launched missiles, SLBMs, precisely to attack the large number of Soviet underground command posts, as well as the increasing number of hardened missile sites. Moreover, the increasing capability of multiple-target, high-yield, and very accurate Trident submarine missiles meant that attacks on most of the Soviet command structure, as well as its missiles, could be launched so close to the Soviet Union as to give no warning, or almost none, to either the high command or the missile launch centers. Indeed, a major rationale then and now for buying and deploying hosts of such warheads capable of destroying super-hardened underground command centers has been to deter Soviet, now Russian, leaders from contemplating a first strike under any circumstances by assuring them that they themselves would not survive the initial exchange, whether we struck first preemptively or not. Given these capabilities, the chance that high-level Soviet officials could actually get to their bunkers in a low-warning attack, or that the shelters would survive our attack, was extremely low. This evident fact, combined with the deliberate publicity given the Carter and Reagan administration's effort to achieve decapitation, could only give a desperate sense of urgency to Soviet leaders and planners to maintain a deterrent retaliatory capability. The only ways to do that were what we ourselves had done in the era of presumed Soviet military superiority. They would either have to delegate authority for launch to lower commanders, and or plan for launch on warning of attack, low, by high commanders, if not by computers, as some military commanders such as NORAD Chief General Lawrence Cooter preferred. As Herbert York recounts, General Cooter told me that we had to complete the BMUs, Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, as soon as possible. and he urged that we expand it in order to create a highly redundant capability at each site. We must expand it in order to have an absolutely reliable early warning of a missile attack. Basically, I agreed. All would have been well if he had stopped there, but he didn't. In words I can't precisely recall, he went on to say that we had to have this redundancy and the resulting high level of reliability so that, when we finally connected the warning system directly to the launch button of our own ICBMs, there would be no false alarms. I was astonished. I told him flatly that we would not automate our response, that we would not connect the warning system directly to the launch button. We would not, in sum, go to a launch-on-warning strategy. York was mistaken in this prediction. We would especially not go to one that did not have the president in the decision-making loop. Cooter coldly replied, "In that case, we might as well surrender now." When I first read of the new emphasis on decapitation during the Carter administration, I worried that this publicity could only press the Soviets into a combination of launch-on-warning and delegation. Strategists like Holloway were gambling that even this pressure wouldn't lead the Bolsheviks to give up their commitment to centralized control. They were mistaken. When the Reagan administration not only continued but also reinforced this public focus, the Soviets, as I expected, worked urgently on means to counteract it. And just like the Americans, just as unaccountably from the point of view of deterrence, they kept these efforts effectively secret. With the ending of the Cold War and the new possibility of open interaction between American and Soviet planners and strategic analysts, Bruce Blair, a former Minuteman control officer who subsequently became an expert in command and control issues, discovered and reported that the Soviets had responded to the threat of decapitation by designing an elaborate system to assure retaliation to an American attack that destroyed Moscow headquarters. Its code name was Perimeter. It was known informally by a Russian phrase that translates as dead hand. Low-level officers in deep underground centers well away from Moscow would receive by a variety of channels several forms of evidence, seismic, electronic, infrared, radioactivity, that Moscow had suffered a nuclear explosion, along with breakage in all forms of communication to and from Moscow. In that event, they were authorized to send off ICBMs that would beep a go signal to any ICBM sites they passed over. The Soviet rockets would not merely communicate an authorization to launch to ground officers, but would actually bypass them and launch the missiles. In an early design of the system, the signals from Moscow would launch the emergency rockets automatically, with no need or allowance for judgment or intervention by humans at the dispersed sites. In other words, this was, at last, the total embodiment of the Doomsday Machine, the device that Hermann Kahn had speculatively imagined in On Thermonuclear War, whose destructive effects would be so total as to provide the ultimate deterrent, while its credibility would be achieved by automaticity. There is some disagreement about whether the Soviet system was to be in continuous operation, or only activated during times of crisis, when the possibility of attack seemed higher than usual, but modernized after the end of the Cold War and up to the present. Whereas Kahn's Doomsday Machine had allowed that an automatic mechanism would be triggered, perhaps by several near-simultaneous explosions on different cities, it appears that the perimeter system would be activated by an attack on Moscow alone. That meant that nuclear winter, which was just coming to be understood as this system went into effect, could have been made inevitable by a single explosion on Moscow. Stanley Kubrick presents this situation in Dr. Strangelove, when the Russian leader informs the U.S. president that if the one American B-52 still on its way to a Soviet target, as the result of an unauthorized action by a squadron commander, is not successfully recalled, which in the film, as in real-life SAC operational planning, neither the president nor anyone else could do once the planes had been ordered to expend, its bomb load will trigger an automatic doomsday machine in the Soviet Union that will destroy all life on Earth. The precise reason the Russian leader gives for having wired up this system is to assure that an attack by the United States would be self-destructive, even if it successfully destroyed Soviet command posts. Dr. Strangelove points out to the Soviet ambassador, present in the war room as a translator and conveyor of the information about the doomsday machine,
that for purposes of deterrence, it would be essential for the United States to know this in advance. But the whole point of the Doomsday Machine is lost if you keep it a secret. Why didn't you tell the world, eh? The ambassador answers, it was to be announced at the Party Congress on Monday. As you know, the premier loves surprises. Satire, of course. But when the Soviets installed Perimeter, they had no intention of announcing it, ever. And they never did, while the USSR existed. The Russians have now acknowledged that they still maintain it, describing it as a doomsday machine. The designer of the secret Soviet perimeter system, Valery Yarenich, regarded his system until his death in December 2012, after decades of consultation on arms control in the United States, as safer than its alternative, which was to rely on launch on warning by high officials in Moscow only. His approach still allowed for launch on warning, as the Russian system, like ours, continues to do, in order to prevent Soviet missiles from being destroyed before they were launched, and to allow them to preempt U.S. missiles promptly that had not yet been launched. But the perimeter system was meant to remove what might present an additional pressure on Soviet commanders in Moscow to launch on warning, if the warning signals seem correct, that there might otherwise be no Soviet retaliation to an American attack because the commanders themselves were about to be destroyed. However, as David Hoffman, former Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, who had interviewed Yarenich many times for his book The Dead Hand, reported in a tribute to him on his death, in later years, Yarenich expressed grave doubts about the very systems of annihilation he had devoted his career to perfecting. He once told me it was utter stupidity to keep the Dead Hand secret. Such a retaliatory system was useful as a deterrent only if your adversary knew about it. More broadly, he came to doubt the wisdom of maintaining the cocked pistols approach to nuclear deterrence, the so-called hair trigger alert, especially after the Cold War ended. He feared it could lead to an accidental or mistaken launch. Yarenich did not keep quiet. He decided to share his insights and worries with the world. This took courage. Even after the Soviet collapse, discussion of such topics remained guarded in Russia. In the early 1990s, Yarenich harbored a dream that someday both the United States and Russia might share the secrets of command and control. He was certain it could lead to deterrence with far fewer nuclear warheads. He also favored taking missiles off launch-ready alert. He tirelessly expounded his logic, yet governments were not interested. The high priests of nuclear command and control could not envision opening up to each other, not here nor in Russia. The bottom line is that arrangements made in Russia and the United States have long made it highly likely, if not virtually certain, that a single Hiroshima-type fission weapon exploding on either Washington or Moscow, whether deliberate or the result of a mistaken attack, as in Failsafe or Dr. Strangelove, or as the result of an independent terrorist action, would lead to the end of human civilization, and most other species. That has been and remains the inevitable result of maintaining forces on both sides that are capable of causing nuclear winter, and at the same time are poised to attack each other's capital and control system, in response to fallible warnings, in the delusion that such an attack will limit damage to the homeland, compared with the consequences of waiting for actual explosions to occur on more than one target. Here, then, is the actual situation that has prevailed for more than half a century. Each side prepares and actually intends to attack the other's military nervous system, command and control, especially its head and brain, the National Command Headquarters, in the first wave of a general war, however it originates. This has become the only hope of preempting and paralyzing the other's retaliatory capability, in such a way as to avoid total devastation. It is what must above all be deterred by the opponent. But in fact, it too is thoroughly suicidal, unless the other side has failed to delegate authority well below the highest levels. Because each side does in fact delegate, hopes for decapitation are totally unfounded. But for the duration of the Cold War, for fear of frightening their own publics, their allies, and the world, neither side discouraged these hopes in the other by acknowledging its own delegation. The only change in this situation has been that in the first few weeks of the Trump administration, Russian news reports have begun acknowledging that the perimeter system persists. In a February 2, 2017 article, Pravda revealed that the commander of Strategic Missile Forces, Lieutenant General Sergei Karakayev, said 5 years ago in an interview in a Russian publication, "Yes, the perimeter system exists. The system is on alert. If there's a need for a retaliatory strike, the command for an attack may come from the system, not people." The Pravda report explained, "Nuclear-capable missile will thus be launched from silos, mobile launches, strategic aircraft, submarines to strike pre-entered targets, unless there is no signal from the command center to cancel the attack. In general, one thing is known for sure. The Doomsday Machine is not a myth at all. It does exist." 10 days after President Trump's inauguration in 2017, Pravda quoted his statements that the United States should strengthen and expand the nation's nuclear capacity and let it be an arms race, and then reported that, not so long ago, the Russian Federation conducted exercises to repel a nuclear attack on Moscow and strike a retaliatory thermonuclear attack on the enemy. In the course of the operations, Russia tested the perimeter system, known as the Doomsday Weapon or the Dead Hand. The system assesses the situation in the country and gives a command to strike a retaliatory blow on the enemy automatically. Thus, the enemy will not be able to attack Russia and stay alive. What has not changed is American preoccupation with threatening Russian command and control. As if all the above revelations, including those of Blair and Yaronich, had not occurred or were thoroughly disbelieved. The National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2017, passed with bipartisan support and signed by President Obama on December 23, 2016, included a provision which mandated a report by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the Strategic Command on Russian and Chinese political and military leadership survivability, command and control, and continuity of governmental programs and activities. This provision of the law called for the U.S. Strategic Command to submit to the appropriate congressional committees the views of the commander on the report, including a detailed description of how the command, control, and communication systems for the leadership of Russia and China, respectively, are factored into the U.S. nuclear war plan. The Pravda news stories quoted above, both appearing in the second week of the Trump administration, were explicitly responding to these provisions of this law signed a few weeks earlier in their explanation of the continuing need for perimeter. Such plans and capabilities for decapitation encourage, almost compel, not only the perimeter system but Russian launch on possibly false warning, either by high command, in expectation of being hit themselves imminently, and in hopes of decapitating the enemy commanders before they have launched all their weapons, or by subordinates who are out of communication with high command and have been delegated launch authority. As General Holloway expressed it in 1980, he had confidence that with such a decapitating strategy, a U.S. first strike would come out much better for the United States than a second strike, to the point of surviving and even prevailing. He was right about the hopelessness of the alternative forms of preemption. But in reality, the hope of successfully avoiding mutual annihilation by a decapitating attack has always been as ill-founded as any other. The realistic conclusion would be that a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviets was, and is, virtually certain to be an unmitigated catastrophe, not only for the two parties, but for the world. But being unwilling to change the whole framework of our foreign and defense policy by abandoning reliance on the threat of nuclear first use or escalation, policymakers, probably on both sides, have chosen to act as if they believed, and perhaps actually do believe, that such a threat is not what it is, a readiness to trigger global omnicide. There is every likelihood that, for comparable reasons, similar secret delegation or dead-hand systems or arrangements exist in every other nuclear weapons state. China, Britain, France, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. Meaning that a Hiroshima-size explosion in any one of their capitals and/or central military headquarters is likely to lead to full-scale launching of their ready forces. The only difference is that none of these states could, at present, cause a full-scale nuclear winter.
though an exchange between any two of them, except North Korea, could trigger enough global reduction in sunlight and loss of harvests for a decade to cause nuclear famine and the starvation of 1 to 2 billion people or more. The Strangelove paradox afflicts not only the United States and Russia. Every new state that acquires nuclear weapons and comes face to face with the vulnerability, both of the weapon systems and of the command and control apparatus, confronts the same incentives, the same pressures from its military to delegate and subdelegate authority to use them, and the same motives to keep that delegation secret from the rest of the world. Deployment of nuclear weapons by a new state doesn't add just one new finger to a trigger on nuclear war. The world worries about the finger of an irresponsible or reckless third world leader, when the finger can just as easily be that of one of the many functionaries working in a far-flung outpost for one of these leaders, new or old. The bottom line, once again, this is not a species to be trusted with nuclear weapons. Above all, not to be trusted with a full or partial doomsday machine. And that doesn't just apply to crazy third world leaders. Chapter 20. First Use Threats. Using Our Nuclear Weapons. From an April 25, 1972 tape of Oval Office conversations, we have the following exchange between Richard Nixon and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger regarding possible American responses to an ongoing North Vietnamese offensive. President: I still think we ought to take the dikes out now. Will that drown people? Henry Kissinger: About 200,000 people. President: Reflective, matter of fact. No. I'd rather use the nuclear bomb. Have you got that, Henry? Kissinger: Like the president, low-key. That, I think, would just be too much. President, in a tone of surprise: The nuclear bomb. Does that bother you? I just want you to think big, Henry, for Christ's sakes. It was not the first time that Nixon had entertained such big thoughts. As his former chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, reported in a memoir written as he awaited a prison term for his role in the Watergate scandal, Nixon had shared elements of his plan to end the Vietnam War during his presidential campaign in 1968. Nixon not only wanted to end the Vietnam War, he was absolutely convinced he would end it in his first year. The threat was the key, and Nixon coined a phrase for his theory, which I'm sure will bring smiles of delight to Nixon haters everywhere. We were walking along a foggy beach after a long day of speechwriting, during Nixon's presidential campaign in 1968. He said, I call it the madman theory, Bob. I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war. We'll just slip the word to them that, for God's sake, you know, Nixon is obsessed about communism. We can't restrain him when he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. And Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace. When I read this in 1978, I had a very uneasy feeling that I might have been the source of this crazy scheme, or at least for the phrase he had coined. I had given 2 lectures to Henry Kissinger's seminar at Harvard in 1959, one titled The Political Uses of Madness. It was from a series of lectures I had given that spring on bargaining theory, with the overall title, The Art of Coercion, A Study of Threats in Economic Conflict and War. To illustrate a counterintuitive proposition in bargaining theory I had arrived at, I pointed to the difficult challenge of making a credible threat to initiate nuclear attacks on a nuclear-armed state or one of its allies. After all, this amounted to a threat of massive suicide murder. The consequences of carrying out this threat were so fearsome that it didn't have to be very credible to be effective in achieving compliance. But at the same time, the consequences for the threateners themselves were such that it was a challenge to make their threat credible at all. I had described, as an example of one possible though dangerous solution to this problem, Hitler's deliberate use of his reputation for madness and unpredictability, impulsiveness, recklessness, rage, to intimidate his adversaries and make his threats and ultimatums effective in the period prior to his actual invasions in World War II. Contrary to the expectations of his own generals, his blackmail had actually succeeded spectacularly in his bloodless occupation of the Rhineland, Austria, the Sudetenland, and Czechoslovakia. So the image of mad unpredictability could work. It actually had for Hitler. But that was in considerable part because he actually was crazy, madly reckless and aggressive. I had never thought of it as an approach that would appeal to an American leader, nor be remotely advisable under any circumstances. When I read Haldeman's memoir, I momentarily worried that Nixon had gotten at least the nickname for his madman theory, and perhaps even the concept, from Kissinger. That is, indirectly from me. To my relief, as I read the account again closely, Haldeman placed the date of this conversation with Nixon in 1968, before Nixon had met Henry Kissinger for the first time in the fall of 1969. For good or ill, and there was nothing good about it, Richard Nixon had adopted this reckless policy without inspiration from Kissinger or me. Rather, the idea of achieving his secretly ambitious aims in Vietnam by nuclear threats had come from a more authoritative source, Dwight Eisenhower, under whom Nixon had served for 8 years as vice president. As Haldeman recounted in this same passage about his madman theory, Nixon saw a parallel in the action President Eisenhower had taken to end another war. When Eisenhower arrived in the White House, the Korean War was stalemated. Eisenhower ended the impasse in a hurry. He secretly got word to the Chinese that he would drop nuclear bombs on North Korea unless a truce was signed immediately. In a few weeks, the Chinese called for a truce and the Korean War ended. Nixon felt that Eisenhower, as former Supreme Commander in Europe in World War II, did not need the hint of madness that Nixon himself did for his nuclear threats to be credible. But according to Haldeman, Nixon believed his hardline anti-communist rhetoric of 20 years would serve to convince the North Vietnamese equally as well that he really meant to do what he said. It was not only Nixon who believed that nuclear threats were critical to achieving the armistice in Korea that is held, uneasily at this point, for the last 64 years. Eisenhower did himself. His former White House Chief of Staff, Sherman Adams, reported asking Eisenhower later how an armistice had at last been reached in Korea. "Danger of an atomic war," he said without hesitation. "We told them we could not hold to a limited war any longer if the communists welched on a treaty of truce. They didn't want a full-scale war or an atomic attack. That kept them under some control." His Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, gave this same explanation. Whether such threats actually affected the Chinese decision-makers, or whether they even received them, remains uncertain and controversial. What is neither uncertain nor inconsequential is that the Eisenhower administration, including Richard Nixon, regarded them as successful. In line with this belief, Eisenhower and Dulles relied on such threats repeatedly, in a series of crises. Dulles's self-congratulatory account in 1956 of the risk-taking strategy underlying the first few of these threats gave rise to the term brinkmanship. In words that echo throughout the Cold War, in fact words that virtually define Cold War in a sense that is returning in the last few years, Dulles said, "Some say that we were brought to the verge of war. Of course we were brought to the verge of war. The ability to get to the verge without getting into the war is a necessary art. If you cannot master it, you inevitably get into war. If you try to run away from it, if you are scared to go to the brink, you are lost." And as I was to discover soon after Nixon left office, this strategy did not end with Dulles and Eisenhower. In September 1974, just after Nixon's resignation, Roger Morris, a former aide to Henry Kissinger, revealed for the first time in the magazine Washington Monthly that Nixon had directed plans for nuclear attacks on North Vietnam in October and November 1969. Morris had participated in an October group in the White House, planning what his boss Kissinger had asked to be a savage, brutal blow that would bring the little fourth-rate country, North Vietnam, to its breaking point. When I asked Morris for specifics after reading that article, he told me that he had read detailed planning folders with satellite photographs for several nuclear targets in North Vietnam. One of these, a transshipment site for material coming in from China, was 1.5 miles from the Chinese border. A nuclear attack on this was meant to send a strong signal to China. A low-yield airburst nuclear weapon above this railroad spur in the jungle, the planning folder estimated, would cause only 3 civilian casualties. Another prospective nuclear target was the Mo Ze Pass from North Vietnam into the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. I had not known at the time about this planning going on in October 1969, just as I was beginning to copy the Pentagon Papers. I would have been astonished to learn of it, so soon in Nixon's first term, even though I was already concerned that another eventual North Vietnamese offensive, perhaps 3 or 4 years off, might trigger use of nuclear weapons. What I had just learned from my friend Morton Halperin, a deputy to Henry Kissinger, who had left the National Security Council in September, was that Nixon, contrary to all public expectations, was not planning to withdraw from Vietnam unconditionally, but was threatening to escalate dramatically to achieve a quasi-victory. Mort told me of the then-secret bombing of Cambodia that was already underway. That was precisely to demonstrate to the North Vietnamese, he said, that despite what the electorate had been led to believe, Nixon was ready to go beyond what LBJ had ever been willing to do. Other measures threatened, not in bluff, included invasion of the sanctuaries of Cambodia and Laos, mining of Haiphong, unrestricted bombing of cities and towns in North Vietnam up to the Chinese border, and possible invasion of North Vietnam. Warnings to the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin as early as May, Halperin told me, had implied a readiness to use nuclear weapons if Nixon's terms were not met. But neither of us imagined then that Nixon was prepared to do this in the fall of his first year. Nevertheless, Halperin's revelations to me of the president's secretly ambitious aims and his reliance on threats of escalation to achieve them were enough to prompt my decision to copy the top-secret Pentagon Papers. I was sure his threats would not succeed, and would instead prolong the ground war and enlarge the air war, with heavy further casualties on both sides. If I had known then about Nixon's imminent nuclear threats and plans, and had any documents on these, I would have revealed them immediately, instead of the history in the Pentagon Papers, which ended in 1968 before Nixon came to office. Later, when the papers were published in 1971, Henry Kissinger's fear that I did know about Nixon's nuclear threats and plans, and might have documents to back it up, was sufficient reason for him to regard me as the most dangerous man in America, who must be stopped at all costs. As I mentioned in the introduction, it was the unlikely exposure of White House crimes against me, actions precisely intended to avert my revealing documents from the Nixon administration beyond the period of the Pentagon Papers, that led to Nixon's resignation facing impeachment, making the war endable 9 months later. What had prevented Nixon's test of the madman theory from being carried out in 1969 was neither any leak of his threats and plans, nor any North Vietnamese compliance with them. It was, as Nixon recounted in his memoirs, the fact that 2 million Americans took part on October 15th in the moratorium, a general strike by another name, a nationwide weekday work and school stoppage, protesting the war. Another demonstration, focused on Washington, was scheduled for 2 days in mid-November. As Nixon says, it was clear to him, given the scale of the first demonstration, that his ultimatum would fail. The North Vietnamese would not believe that he could continue such attacks in the face of this unprecedented popular resistance. He secretly gave up his plans for attacking the North at that time. But he continued until the end of the month, with a secret global alert of SAC, deliberately designed to be visible to Soviet intelligence, but not to the American public, with the intent of making his nuclear threats credible to the Soviets and the North Vietnamese, while keeping them unknown to the public. That alert, which included SAC bombers flying round-the-clock missions with weapons aboard, a renewal of the air alert that McNamara had discontinued in 1968 because of an accident, was meant to convey to the Soviets, in effect, "We really are preparing to hit your ally with nuclear weapons if they don't meet our terms. Don't think of making any nuclear response if we have to do that. We're poised to meet that immediately with a preemptive attack." This was, after all, exemplary of what I now understand to have been the major purpose of U.S. strategic weapons since the early 50s. To deter, with confidence, Soviet second-use retaliation to U.S. first use of tactical weapons against Soviet forces or their allies. By threatening that if the Soviets made a nuclear response in kind with its own tactical weapons, SAC might escalate to a full first strike against the Soviet